And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. This week is the kickoff of yet another season of the PBS series POV. POV, of course, stands for Point of View. And the series also stands for the very, very best in independent documentaries. And as Morning Show listeners know, I am very, very fond of this series and take every opportunity I can to interview the filmmakers who produce these superlative films that we've had the privilege to watch over the last few years. And this latest season of POV begins in stunning fashion with an absolutely remarkable film, which is called Out in the Night. The story of this film begins with a night in the spring of 2006 on a street in New York City, I believe in the West Village, when seven African-American women, who happened to be seven African-American lesbians, were accosted rather violently and aggressively by a man on the street and fought back, defending themselves, and ultimately were charged with gang assault and even attempted murder. And the firestorm of media coverage in the wake of that was really astonishing, and I think for most people, especially in retrospect, quite disturbing, the ways in which various branches of the media leapt to all kinds of unfortunate conclusions based on all kinds of stereotypes. Ultimately, three of the seven women accepted guilty pleas and essentially very, very reduced sentences, but four maintained their innocence. And this film is the story of their struggle for justice in the wake of conviction and incarceration and perpetual misunderstandings. And the film also touches on all kinds of very, very important issues related to how we view each other in society, how we react to being threatened, and how our past history can often have a very strong guiding hand in how we are apt to respond to the attacks of others or the aggressiveness of others. And I could go on and on, but it's time for me to bring in our two very special guests. First of all, I'm very privileged to be speaking with Blair Droesch-Walther, who is the director and producer of this marvelous film.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Blair is a social issue documentary director, production designer, artist, and also is in direct care with adults with developmental disabilities, mental illness, addiction, homelessness, and HIV/AIDS. Along with Blair, I'm also very pleased and privileged to welcome to the Morning Show Renata Hill, who happens to be one of the four women whose story is told in this film, Out in the Night. Renata Hill, we welcome you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really glad we can have this conversation. Blair Droesch-Walther, I want to get one thing out of the way right off the bat. Something that surprised me a bit in the statement that is on the PBS website talking about this film. And by the way, I hope anybody who finds themselves intrigued by the film will go to the PBS website and read what you have written there. One of the things you said is words to the effect that originally you didn't feel like you, as a white director, were maybe the right person to tell this story as a filmmaker. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little more about that assumption that you made, at least for a time, and then what ultimately sort of shook you loose from that mistaken assumption that the color of your skin had anything to do with whether or not you should be the person in the director's chair producing such a film?
Well, I think, you know, I think that historically and very much still today, stories of people of color, specifically Black Americans, are told through a white lens, whether that be in the news, in novels, in movies, and same is true for documentaries. And I think that's a dangerous precedent that has been set, and there is privilege that comes with being the director or the writer or the journalist on somebody else's life. And I think that that needs to be a question for all directors when they choose to tell a story, is what, you know, what drew them to the story and why are they interested in telling it. And I will also say that I don't think that enough white directors talk about why they chose to tell a story of people of color and acknowledge that privilege and that kind of entitlement that comes along with that. So I think that it's important to discuss. And I wanted to make sure, because, you know, we have overlapping identities of being born women, of being gender nonconforming, of being lesbians and being queer, and you know, experiencing street harassment. We have overlapping identities, but I do think that a big part of this case was about their race, and I don't think, had they been white, this outcome would have happened, both in the media and in the criminal legal system. So I think that that separation, that I don't have, you know, direct experience to, was something to be aware of and to question whether or not I should be the one to tell it. Because ultimately, anytime you tell a story, it goes through, it's through your lens, through your experiences, through how you view the world. So I wanted to honor that their space and that, you know, I really felt that a person of color should direct this if a film was going to be made. And I do think oftentimes films aren't done well because they're kind of othering the people that are in the story. It's this, you can kind of tell there's this separation and there's this like voyeuristic aspect to it. So I was very conscious of that originally, and I did find out about the assault within the day or the days following. So I got involved as an activist, and I also feel like that was really important. I was an activist for 2 years on their case before I ever thought about the film, the idea of a film again. So I think that was also really important for my journey, is that I was invested very deeply in their outcome, totally separate of a potential film being made. So those were kinds of the things that were going through my head at the time. And then the reason I ended up doing the film is in 2008, when their appeals were approaching, I realized I still felt very passionate and outraged by it. You know, it was just one of those stories I couldn't get out of my head. So that's when I started rethinking about it as a film. And also the media attention had severely died down. So I approached the women and their family members and their attorneys to see if there was interest in a film and to see if there's interest in me telling their story. And we began this kind of long interview process of getting to know each other. I was visiting them constantly. Their appeals were actually really long and complicated, especially Renata's. We didn't go into it as much in the film, but there was a lot happening, and we were going back and forth to court every month for 6 months for Renata, twice for Venice, and that was separate of their appeals after their appeals had happened. So there was a very direct investment in their outcomes. And I think that was a part of also why we clicked, is that they saw that I was invested in their case separate of the film.
Hmm.
But we ended up clicking, and it made sense, I think, for all of us. We, you know, they felt comfortable with me, and we took it from there.
Renata Hill, as you first met Blair and the possibility of her making a film about you was being discussed, were you at all taken aback by the fact that this was a white person who was potentially coming on board to tell your story? Did that give you any sense of hesitancy the way that it evidently did her in the beginning? Or did her skin color not matter to you?
Not so intense. Like, at the very beginning when she came up there to see us, when I seen her, she, you know, was white, I questioned who she was. And when she talked about it, I just felt like at first I was feeling that she was an undercover reporter. Because I was like, why would she be so interested in what it is that, you know, we went through? But as she started to stick around and be more interested and become very resourceful and helpful towards us, I realized that, you know, her feelings about what transpired was genuine, and I never questioned or looked at her, you know, as far as her color after that. I was just more so really happy and grateful that someone was willing to step forward and express that this really outraged them and was willing to hear our side of the story, and not just hear our side of the story, but to get it out there, you know, so that way we can fight back against what was said against us in the newspaper. Hmm.
By the way, I think one thing that also we should sort of get out of the way is the matter that on that night in 2006, this incident, which sparks all of the events in the film, involved seven women. But ultimately, right, this film is about four of you, because three of you decided to plead guilty and, in a sense, be done with all of this as much as possible. We never really learn anything at all about them, that is, those three, through the course of the film. Right. I'm just wondering, first of all, did you, Blair, I guess I'm talking to you now, did you think very much about whether or not they should figure at all in this film, even though their story is vastly different from that of the four people to whom you really focus your attention? And was that all at all sort of a tricky matter?
Yeah, I mean, I initially reached out to all seven. My first letters were to all seven before I went to visit them. These four women in prison, and it took a while to get in touch with the other three because, you know, the sending letters to these four when they were incarcerated, I knew they were getting them, but I wasn't entirely sure where the other three were at the time. So it actually took a bit of time to find them, and I did speak with them, with all of them, about their interest in being in the documentary. Two of them I thought were really close to it. They agreed, and then kind of the day of that we were going to shoot, they changed their mind. So I think in the end, they just felt that they wanted to move on with their lives, and they weren't interested in kind of bringing this up again, because I think at this point it was 2 or 3 years later, and they were just trying to live their lives. So initially I had approached all of them, and I did want them all to be in it. And so the reason that we ended up not showing their names in the film, even though, you know, you can find them online, I felt that if they wanted to move on with their lives, I didn't want to put their names out there so publicly. And kind of honor and respect that.
Sure. Renata Hill, if you don't mind my asking, does the fact that those three made a very different choice from the choice which you made and the other three that we come to know in this film, has that, in a sense, been a source of maybe awkwardness or estrangement? What does it mean for you to have had them make such a different choice for themselves? Is that a choice which you're able to accept?
I mean, of course, I have to respect that. You know, I'm the type of person that I'm just not going to lay down for just anything, you know, and because at that moment, although we all were very young, I still believed in the system. You know, I believed in right and wrong, and I felt like what we went through that night was wrong on the guy's behalf. Like, he had no right to attack us and come at us the way he did, and we felt threatened. We had every right to defend ourselves. So I felt like because my faith in the system, I thought that justice would be served, and, you know, they would see it for what it was, which was self-defense, and that we all would be released. So I was willing to, me and the other three women that are in the documentary, we was willing to take that chance, although we was facing 25 years. We just did not see anything going wrong, you know. And the other three women, I guess, you know, looking at 25 years and taking that chance, it scared them, and they made a decision that they didn't want to fight against it, and, you know, they just wanted to plead guilty at that moment, so that way it was like an immediate release, you know, 6 months and 5 years probation, parole, you're going home, you know, like within a day. So I really can't be upset about that. That's a choice that they decided to make, and I was presented with that same choice also, but I wasn't going to accept that. I didn't feel like I should be forced basically to plead guilty to something that I really don't feel like I'm guilty about. So, you know, again, I can't put on them, I can't make them put on them more than they can bear themselves. So if they didn't want to take that chance, I can't really be upset about that.
Hmm. Well put. For those of you just joining us on the morning show today, we are previewing a marvelous documentary film which airs this week on the PBS series POV. This is the first documentary of its newest season. The film is called Out in the Night. It recounts what occurred on a night in the spring of 2006 when seven African-American lesbians, actually from Newark, New Jersey, in a neighborhood in New York City, were approached and in sort of escalatingly aggressive fashion, really accosted and even attacked by this man, and defended themselves, but to the point that they ended up being charged with an array of charges, including assault and even attempted murder. We're speaking today with Blair Droesch-Walther, who is the director and producer of this film, and with Renata Hill, one of the four women who chose to plead not guilty to the charges and struggled for years to ultimately secure justice for themselves. Blair Droesch-Walther, I really appreciate the way in which this film begins, in a sense, in such lighthearted fashion, as you try to, as you introduce us to these four women, and really to the joyous lives which, in so many respects, they were enjoying together at the time that this event occurred in 2006. Just say a word about the importance of setting the stage in your film in this particular way.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want people to see them as these incarcerated women, and as though that would define who they are. So I wanted people to really get a sense of their personalities and their kind of fun-loving spirit and the connections they have with each other, and to really get to know them as human beings. You know, so much of the media dehumanize them, use this animalistic language, refers to them as gangs, and really painted this picture of these hardened criminals that we shouldn't feel anything for. So I wanted to make sure we started with people just getting to know them in a really lighthearted setting before we, you know, moved on to kind of what the case is.
Mm.
So I think it was really important to combat some of that media imagery.
Renata Hill, as we first get to know you in this film, one of the really delightful little moments is when you talk about coming out to your mother. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
All right. So when I was 20, my mom called me at my job and said, first she had been hanging around this masculine identified woman that she called her best friend. And, you know, my stepfather was living in the house with us, and me and my stepfather talked about it. Like, I think that's a girlfriend or whatever. And I had also had been hanging out on chat lines and stuff, and I had, you know, a girlfriend and also my son's father staying with me. So my mom called me at work and said, hey, I have something to tell you when you get off from work. What time do you get off? And I'm like, well, I already know what it is. And she's like, I'm pretty sure you don't. I was like, yeah, I do, but I have something to tell you too. So when I went home and, you know, we sat down for a conversation and, you know, you could see it in her face, whatever it was, she just really wanted to get it off her chest. So she told me, like, yeah, you know, I'm gay. I like women. And I was like, yeah, me too. And she was like, no, you're not. No, you're not. And I'm like, yeah, really, I am. And then she said, you know, have you ever kissed a girl yet? And I'm like, not yet, but I have this one girlfriend, you know. And we just started having a conversation about it. And, like, my stepfather was stuck in awe. My son's father was stuck in awe. And it was just like, me and my mom just felt like we were just finally free, you know, go on our journey, find some girlfriends, and just, like, you know, have fun.
Huh. it's not often that a coming out occurs in that particular fashion, where it's essentially a simultaneous coming out of mother and daughter. And it's really intriguing also to think about how close one can be to someone and yet not realize that about the other, or maybe not want to realize that about the other.
Right.
Tell us what your relationship is now after all that you've been through. Or what it, I should say.
My relationship with who?
I misstated that a little bit. Tell us about how your relationship went forward with your mother, and particularly through some of the events in this film.
Well, me and my mom has always, my mom had a drug abuse problem growing up. So we didn't really have much history, but I've always, regardless of what I went through, I grew up in a broken home. I've always honored my mother. You know, I've never really held any resentment towards her, although she didn't know that all those years. So getting into this situation, it really took her aback. You know, she never knew that side of me that they portrayed me to be, you know, and it was hard for her to really deal with, but she was, you know, really supportive. And I remember once she came out of her denial stage of what was really going on, it was once I got sentenced, I guess it became reality for her. And just her coming up there to the prison to see me and talking to me I was on this blog and, you know, you're all over the paper now, and I'm talking, you know, putting a lot of positive things out there. So, you know, people, you should be getting a lot of letters. And, she was just really excited about just trying to be a part of or being a part of trying to shed some light on our situation and allowing society to know who we really were. And then unfortunately, once I was granted my appeal and I was brought back down to the county jail in 2008 in June, I remember my mom used to call up to the prison when I was in maximum security prison and say it was a family emergency. And when I would call home, mom, what's wrong? She's nothing. I didn't hear from you for a couple of days. I wanted to make sure you was all right. And I'm Mom, I'm in prison. I'm not going anywhere, you know. You have to stop calling in prison. So when I went down, when I got transferred down to Rikers Island, it was a couple of days that I hadn't spoken to her. So I was let me call this lady before, she called up here. And when I called my best friend and had my best friend at the time call my mom, I was faced with the news that my mom had just passed away, right before I made the phone call. So she didn't get the opportunity to see the documentary or the making of the documentary. The part of the documentary that she is in is actually of some type of meeting. She was doing an interview she went to at, Blue Stockings Bookstore, mm-hmm. I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And I remember her coming up there telling me about that. So, I hold on to that part of the documentary. That's one of my favorite parts because, that's the only moment I have left of her. It is that, you know, so moving forward, I know that she's down, she's up there looking down, just, really, really proud that I'm just, taking all of this with so much grace and keeping my head up. But she hasn't really been a part of, the documentary process because she had already passed away at the time.
I'm sorry about that. We should talk about what occurred on that spring evening in 2006. And Blair DeRoche-Walther, I wonder if you could say a word about the challenge of, in a sense, recreating that night and that event in the way that you did, in part through the utilization of film footage, which occurs that is available because of the surveillance cameras that were operating that night. And of course, it is sort of an imperfect bit of footage, and yet it really brings us right into the heart of what occurred. Tell us more about the challenge of bringing that so vividly to life for the viewer.
Yeah, that was a bit of a challenge. We initially, I had wanted to have I wanted to show the fight from the women's perspective and also show it from the man's perspective, and then put those kind of splice in the security valence, security footage with those accounts to kind of show, you know, as much of an objective view as possible. And my idea with that was for people to watch the fight and come away with their own conclusion. But even, and maybe somebody's conclusion would be that women went too far and they weren't justified. And then my argument is that even if that were true, everything that came afterwards wasn't justified. The news response, the charges, the convictions, the sentencing. Ultimately, the man involved did not want to be a part of the film. We spoke many times over the years, and he chose not to. So we used his testimony on the stand as kind of filler for what his accounts were of that night. But I also, you know, we tell the story twice. We have Renata and Train kind of walk through what they remember of the fight on location, and we have his testimony. But that's also when we talk a little bit about Renata's past history with sexual trauma. We have Patrice talking about her history with police brutality to try to build more context, because I don't think that it's a matter of what just happened that night. I think it's about what led up to that night, and the context for how threatened they felt was very much a part of their past experiences and their, you know, them feeling unable to call police for protection. But also, even in this very particular situation, you know, if somebody would have called 911, most likely Renata would have been dead because she was being choked. So that was the first way we tell the story, and then the second way we tell it is through surveillance footage. And through the surveillance footage, we only pulled out things that we could prove, things that were visible in the surveillance camera and things that were backed up by everyone's testimony. So it was a really fine line to make sure, you know, we weren't putting our own opinions into it, or we weren't portraying it the way we think it went down. We really tried to make sure it was what we could prove happened. And the surveillance camera we received from the three surveillance cameras we received from a Freedom of Information Act request. And that took a long time to get. So it was a long period of trying to figure out how to do that.
Right. Well, it's a very powerful element in the film, and I'm so glad that footage can be part of this. Renata Hill, the way this man describes it in his trial testimony, he characterizes it as, in a sense, what he said to the seven of you as you passed by, as pretty innocent in the beginning, and then something that just sort of escalated, got out of hand somehow. Is that a fair assessment, that the beginning of this encounter was at least relatively innocent? Or do you feel like from the very first moment, I mean, and the first words he was saying to you, that this was an overtly threatening move on his part?
Yeah, I don't agree at all that it was any innocence to it. Like, you know, it's just a certain, everybody deserves a certain level of respect, and I just don't think that we have to be subjected to a man, you know, us walking past a man and him saying, "Let me get some of that," like, as your pickup line. Like, there's nothing innocent to that, and you're pointing to, you know, a girl who can pass to be about 12 years old, okay, because Patrice is the smallest of all of us, and she just has a really young face, and you're pointing to her vagina, like, while saying, "Let me get some of that." Like, that is the ultimate disrespect. And even though it was so rude and disrespectful, you know, with Patrice being so innocent, she thought that the guy was actually asking for some soda that one of the other girls was holding. So she said to the girl, "Let him have your soda." And then he, you know, said, "No, I want some of that," again pointing to her vagina. And once we all realized, like, is this man serious? You know, she's like, "Oh, no, mister, I'm gay." She's still calm. We all calm. I'm a lesbian. And you've seen the whole shift in his body. Like he wasn't feeling the fact that he just got rejected. And then, you know, I like to joke. I laugh a lot. I think everything is a joke. I don't take too much serious. And I said, you know, "These are all my girlfriends. Like, don't worry about it. They all with me," you know, and that really just sent him over the top. And that's when he just really started to get yelled, and we started to yell, and then the crowd formed because of the things that he's saying out of his mouth about, you know, I'll F you straight, you know, so much disrespect on top of disrespect, and to the point that he hogs it, okay, he's calling us men, you know, you think you're a man, you think you're a man, and at that point, I'm saying, I'm not a man. Like, I know I'm a woman. I'm not a man with my hand on my breast, like, acknowledging that I am a woman, you know. And he spit in my face, and he threw a cigarette at me. Once that transpired and that he was already close to my face, that's when, like, I felt really threatened. I was afraid for my life. He had a book bag on. I didn't know what was going to happen. And next thing I know, a fight broke out, and, you know, everything went from there. And it got to the point that even, you know, bystanders, men that don't know us at all, you know, felt the need to jump into the fight and defend us, because there was no time, there was no point in time where we all could just get away from this man, you know, and into a safe space. Like, there was no, he was coming after us back to back to back, you know, and the only way we was able to actually escape that event that night without, like, real serious injuries to us was the fact that these men decided to jump in and take him on.
Right. And they jumped in to defend you. They didn't jump in to defend him from you.
Absolutely.
They were defending you from him, which speaks volumes about exactly what was transpiring on that street. Nevertheless, of course, and very much unfortunately for you, when the police are called and come to the scene, their interpretation, of course, is very, very different from all of that.
Right.
Renata Hill, one of the things we should touch on is the fact that there was, and Blair's already touched on this, the fact that there is in your own past a history which helps us understand why you especially felt so threatened in this moment, and why, very authentically, you were acting, all that you did and said was very much in self-defense. Just say a word about this part of you and this part of who you are, which is essential to us understanding what happened that night.
I mean, like I said before, I grew up in a broken household, and, you know, at one point, at 9 years old, the man that my mom was married to started to molest me and rape me whenever he felt like he wanted to, and I had to endure that up until I was about 12 years old. And, you know, I just know, I've seen this man not only violate me, but, like, I've seen him have a gun to my mom's head. I've seen him snap my mom, like, shoulder out of her pocket, like, kick my mom down flights of stairs, and, like, just really hold her addiction over her like he had control, you know. So I know what it's like to be violated, to be abused, and not respected. And that's not the first time it's happened. Like, it's repeatedly happened in my life, not just by him, but later on in life, as, you know, when I was grown or whatever, I had to endure that. And it's just like, at, you know, at some point, you don't have to accept that. Like, it took a long time and a lot of work and a lot of therapy for me to really understand that I can protect myself. I have the right to protect myself. I don't have to tolerate people doing things to me that I don't agree with. So being put in that situation that night and the things that he was saying, of course, I'm thinking back to, like, this is one of those moments again that, you know, this guy is just clearly going to, he feel like he can just do and say whatever he wants to us. And he's making it clear. He just, like, that he wants. And all I'm saying in my head, all I'm thinking is, like, if we're telling you that we're lesbians and you're saying this to us, clearly you're not respecting, you know, our way of living and who we are. And clearly you're saying that you basically rape us, because if we're lesbian, clearly we're not going to, you know, you're going to violate us or whatever. And then, like I said, once he was close to me and I really felt threatened and trapped, like there was really nowhere to go. And I, you know, once everything started happening, the only thing that's on my mind is, not again. It won't happen to me again, whatever it is. Like, this guy is not going to get away with it. I have the right to protect myself. Like, I'm not going to die in this situation. I don't have to lay there and accept anything, you know, and also the safety of my friends. Like, we're all women, you know, like, this guy was really, really strong. So, yeah, we had to, like, really protect one another, like, so that we can, you know, go home safely, you know, and alive, mainly.
For those of you just joining us.
And I actually will just add to that real quickly that, you know, Renata's incredibly open and willing to talk about her experiences growing up. But I also think that, you know, if you're a woman on the street or you're queer identified and you're being sexually harassed on the street at 2 o'clock in the morning, that's a threatening feeling. And, you know, when you have one out of four women being sexually molested by the time they're 18, the chances are it's going to bring up a past, you know, it's going to spark PTSD. But even if you are somebody that hasn't experienced sexual trauma, that's still a vulnerable feeling to be in, to have somebody say such crazy things like that to you in the middle of the night when you're just trying to walk down the street.
So that is not the time to be careless with one's own language and in something like that. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about the POV film Out in the Night, which kicks off a new season of POV. We're speaking with the director-producer of the film, Blair Droschwalther, and with Renata Hill, who is one of the four women whose story is told so vividly in this film. Blair Droschwalther, in the wake of this and in the wake of these arrests, there is a firestorm of media attention, and you give us a generous sampling of it. And what's really a remarkable part of the film, I think, is when you actually have us hear for a few moments from one of the writers responsible for some of what was written about this incident and the kind of sensational headlines that were crafted. Can you just say a word about including the words and the perspective of this female reporter from the New York Post, who was part of this shameful bit of shabby journalism?
Yeah, I reached out to a number of the journalists. Some of them responded, some didn't. I spoke with a few of them. Many of them didn't want to go on camera. But ultimately, when I was speaking with this journalist, Laura Italiano, we had this conversation over the phone before we decided to move forward, and she was explaining that the headline writers are separate from the journalists who write the articles. So the attack of the killer lesbians and I'm a man growled lesbian, you know, all these crazy headlines that the Post had, she said, you know, she was basically saying she had nothing to do with them, and that she hopes that those headlines grab people's attentions and then they read the real article. So in the interview, that's why I tried to pull out specific language she used in the article, calling them bloodthirsty, which is not a word you use to describe people. That's a word you use to describe a werewolf or a vampire. And she called them seething sapphic septet. And it just, she couldn't see how that, or wouldn't acknowledge on camera, at least, how that was wrong and dehumanizing, and that she was talking about real people whose lives were at stake here. And even if you don't know exactly or don't believe exactly what happened, I think it's pretty clear that there was some fear on behalf of these women, you know? And I think that as a woman, to not identify with another woman experiencing sexual harassment on the street, especially in New York City, is unfathomable to me. So she was a very interesting character, and I was a bit surprised that she wasn't willing to take any sort of responsibility for her words.
Hmm. Ultimately, of course, the four of you are found guilty and sentenced to various sentences of incarceration. For you, Renata, sentenced to 8 years in prison, I believe.
Right.
One of the most painful aspects of that was that this meant separation from your son, TJ, who we hear from in this film. And that, of course, provides some of the most touching moments as well. Describe what that was like and how it was possible for you to survive such a sorrow.
That was like one of the most painful moments, even with everything I've endured in life. Like, that was one of the most painful moments of my life. It's just like calculating, okay, my son is going to be a teenager by the time I get home. Like, he's not going to know who I am. You know, up until that day, me and my son was like always together. We was never separate, you know. Even if he went to go spend a night with his father, it was like only one night he was allowed to go, because like I needed him, you know, to be with me. He's my strength and my motivation to move forward every day. And I always wanted to protect him from the world, you know, from ever enduring anything close to what I had to go through growing up. And knowing that I wasn't going to be there to protect him from that, and knowing I wasn't going to be there to nurture him and bring him up and raise him for so many years, it just, I really felt like my life for those next 8 years was pointless. And I can't lie, at certain points, I just didn't even want to live anymore, because I'm like, I'd rather just be gone than to live every day knowing that I'm not going to see my son for 8 years. And then at some point, you know, I even had a moment when I was in a cell and I hallucinated a little bit, and I woke up feeling like, you know, I seen my mom and my son there, and the judge said I can leave. And I'm like really feeling, you know, holding my son's hand, and he's like, "Mommy, you can leave." And it felt like I felt a hand in my hand. And as he walked out the door and I went to go walk out the door, like I ran straight into the door. And then that's when reality hit, like, oh, wow, this was like a dream, but I was awake for the entire thing. And I just, like, I really lost it at that point. And I don't know, I guess at some point I just, like, the fact that all of us women were together at the very beginning when we was in Rikers Island, they looked to me for a lot of guidance. And, like, because I said, I'm the jokester. I'm the one that, like, keeps everything alive and laughing. And I felt like, okay, my son is not here for me to guide him, but I have to be here for these women. Like, we have to do this together, you know. And this kind of became a little bit easier that they was there for me, because I was able to help them, but they don't even know how much they really was helping me by giving me something to look forward to, something to do, you know, to have a role to play. And you know, I just kept it honest with my son. You know, I told him, I explained the entire situation to him. I didn't tell him I was going off to college. I didn't tell him that this was a camp that I was in. I explained the exact situation that happened, you know, the same way you would talk and explain to an adult. And he understood, you know, he understood. And I told him, you know, I'll see you. It's going to take a while, but I'll see you again. And he held on to that. And throughout my years of being in prison, you know, for his birthday, Christmas, Valentine's Day, you know, I had a little East Bay book that I could send him little gifts, you know, home. So I sent him a basketball, he had a football, he had a book bag, and things of that nature. And he, you know, he wrote to me, and I wrote back to him. I sent him handkerchiefs and things of that nature. So I was just like, you know, I had some type of connection with him, and that kept me moving forward.
Mm. It's ultimately one of the most touching parts of the film, and especially when we hear from him what this was like, and we hear from you how hard it was to have him visit, knowing that he was leaving and going, you know, riding that long bus ride back home, and in some ways that even exacerbated the pain of your separation, fortunately.
Right.
And of course, we also hear in the film about you temporarily losing custody of TJ, although once you were released, able to regain that, and now you are building a very, very happy life for him and your new family. Blair Droesch-Walther, what is your sense of what a difference it made, the making of this film, in the lives of these four women and also those who cared about them and loved them so much? I mean, one thinks about what this would have been like for them if there had not been some sort of vehicle for them to share their story and have their voices heard in this way. What kind of difference do you think it made for them in their lives?
Well, that might be a better question for them. I do think that, well, one thing, I'll say this. One thing that I've noticed since we premiered last June, and we had a festival and college university run. We've been in about 90 festivals. So the women have been out speaking since last June, and I've definitely noticed a growth in them through that period. And I think it's been really powerful for them to see audiences react to them, both in this way of it was visualizing support that they had. You know, getting letters in prison is so important but being able to see people's reactions and support, I think, was really important. And also to be able to connect with people who have been through maybe something similar in some way in the film, or just come up to them and, you know, to say that I'm with you, I support you. I think that that's been really important. But we also have to remember that, you know, there's over 2 million people who are incarcerated. So there are so many stories that, that need to be told. And I think it's really powerful to be able to tell your own story and to be able to travel around the country talking about it. So I think that it's incredibly important for them. But I think that they're also taking on this new role of being advocates and speaking for, you know, other people that they knew who were incarcerated, and being kind of a voice that's out there and being listened to now. So I think that part's been really important.
We should mention
Let me just jump in on this. I don't think Blair gives herself enough credit. I don't think she really knows the impact that she has had on our lives. And this coming from me, like, I think if Blair had not approached us about this documentary, or even cared enough to allow us to share our story with the world, it would have been a point where I would have just, you know, started to really believe, like, I did something wrong. You know, like, I'm just this horrible person, and I just did this horrible thing, and I would have sat with that for a long time. The same way I sat with, you know, me being molested and raped growing up, I sat with that for a long time until I found the voice about that. The fact that Blair cared and gave us that outlet to be able to share it with the world and to be able to go to different screenings and see all the different reactions, like, she gave us a second chance, you know, because coming home with a felony and then going to look for jobs and going to apply for apartments and going through the shelter system and trying to get custody of your kid back and having to answer all these questions to the judge and all of that, it's like, and you're constantly being convicted over and over again. Nobody wants to hear your story. All they see is what's in black and white on paper. You're a felon, you know, gang assault, attempted murder, you know, assault in the first or whatever. That's all they see. There's no second chance to really be able to explain that. So now living with that past and then moving forward to a different future with this documentary and people getting to know who we are, you know, it's a blessing, and I'm honored, you know what I'm saying? I'm honored to be able to share my story, and I'm honored to have been able to work with Blair, you know, and very grateful that she cared enough to actually follow through and to finish it, because that was a long process, too. Blair has been dealing with us and working behind our case for 9 years, and the documentary itself took about 7 years, and funding was a really big issue, and I can honestly say that I probably would have gave up, you know, and then you have four women who all got four different personalities, you know, we didn't make it easy for her, you know, it was a real difficult process, but she was so passionate enough about, you know, our story, and she got to know us and knew that, you know, we was being truthful, and she wanted everybody to know that. You know, and she did a really, really good job in doing that, you know, with the finishing product.
I so agree. It's an absolutely remarkable film, and I am so glad it was made and that we can all experience it now. Again, the film is called Out in the Night, and it's directed and produced by Blair Droeschwalther. Blair Droeschwalther, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show, and I congratulate you on a fine film. And Renata Hill, you have added so much to this interview today, and I'm so glad that your life is where it is now, and that you took time from a busy life to also be part of this conversation and about this really important film. Thank you to both
Thank
of you.
Thank you.
The POV documentary, Out in the Night, will air tonight on Milwaukee Public Television Channel 10. And if you would like more information, you should go to npr.org and click on the link for POV, where you can find out more information about this remarkable film and about future POV documentaries. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear the first of a two-part interview with a former Racinian by the name of David Roselle, looking back on his many years growing up at the Taylor Children's Home, or Taylor's Children Asylum, as it was known. This was an orphanage, which no longer exists on the south side of Racine, but he looks back on his time there with great, great fondness. His memoir about the experience is called The Boy Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree. Join us tomorrow and the beginning of Wednesday's Morning Show for that conversation. Our forecast is going to change quite drastically. Partly sunny skies giving way to cloudy skies, and then very strong shower and thunderstorm activity. Some could be very strong, even severe. Even tornadoes are possible with some of this activity moving into southern Wisconsin. We could see rain by mid-morning. A high today of 89 degrees, just a little bit cooler near the lake, with more rain likely tonight. This is W.